So thank you very much for attending this study half day. This is the fourth study half day this semester, after one on the American elections, one on the Franco-British Empire and its consequences, one on the National Front in France, and today one on narrating migrant voices. So the idea started from one unit that we had at level five. I see that some of the students from this unit are here, which is about people on the move. The unit has been questioned, why don't you call it immigration? No, there are people, and they're moving. So there's a lot of different type of people are moving. So within this unit, we started to look at immigration policy and immigration flux, if you want to. But at one point, it's necessary not to talk in terms of numbers, in terms of policy, but the people who are moving themselves. And one of the questions is, how do you talk about those people? Who's talking about those people? And how do you make them visible or invisible in different contexts? And I think that the three speakers we have today are going in different ways to address this particular issue. We have, maybe not in the order they're going to appear, but we first of all have writer and novelist Myriam Halami, okay, who has written a different novels, but the one today we're going to look at is called Hidden, and it's mainly geared towards the teenage market. And it's about asylum seekers not very far away, just around the corner, on Hailing Island, and the sort of issues it creates among a community of teenagers. Our second guest speaker is Professor Martin Evans. He's also a friend for a long time. We shared an office for 17 years. So that's quite a long time.
The place was all mine, rather than Emmanuel.
So Martin is working at Sussex University, not very far away, but is also has been working a lot with museums, and especially with the which is not a city, but a musée de l'immigration, de l'histoire de l'immigration, the Museum of the History of Immigration, in Paris. And what he's going to do is, as he's going to be the curator of an exhibition started in October of next year, yeah?
Yeah, next year.
Okay, to see how in France and in the UK the image of the post-colonial world and migrants in that post-colonial context is articulated or represented, okay? And the third speaker that we have today is Jacob Preuss, okay, who last night broadcasted or showed the his film When Paul Came Over the Sea. And Jacob is a film documentary maker, director. This last film, which has not been premiered yet, so we only saw some extract recently. The idea is when you are reporting, when you are trying to film migrants, at what point, if I understood it this way, at one point your role as recording what is happening change or may change and to what extent, okay? Can you simply report without and remain neutral about it, okay? So three different ways of mediating those voices. So this is my great pleasure to welcome Myriam Halami, who is a writer, as I said at the beginning, and who is going to talk to us today about the novel she published called Hidden. There's an H somewhere in English there. I just maybe for 25 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you very much.
So thanks very much for inviting me, Emmanuel. It's really exciting to be here. Particularly as my book is set down the road on Hailing Island. Do you all know where Hailing Island is?
Yeah.
Because normally, you see, I talk to 200 13-year-olds in a school hall, and they all just, none of them smile at me. They all just sit there like this, you know. And I have this whole presentation to wind them up and wake them up. So I won't be giving you that presentation today. And, of course, anywhere outside the South Coast, I do come down here quite a lot and talk about the book. And I ask them if they've heard of Hailing Island, and they never have. So then I have to air draw the map in the and show them where it is. So Emmanuel asked me to answer some questions today, so that helped me really sort of to move away from my school presentation. So I was a teacher for 25 years, and I taught children with special needs, and I taught in inner London around Camden for part of the time. But I started writing for children and young people about 7 or 8 years ago, and those are the books that I publish. And so Hidden was the first novel that I wrote for what we call young adults. It's sort of 10-year-olds upwards actually read it. So the first thing really is to think about why would I, or what the book is about, two teenagers who are walking on the beach on Hailing Island one day, and they see a man fall in the sea out of a boat. And they go into the water, and if anybody knows the water down by the lifeboat station at Hailing Island Yacht Club, you're not supposed to even paddle in there, it's very dangerous. But Alex, who's one of the 14-year-olds, knows this, she lives down there, but she still goes in and she pulls the man out. And she is with her 14-year-old friend, she's only just got to know him really. He's known as the foreign boy at school, his name is Samir. And he came into England as an unaccompanied child asylum seeker. And he lives now with his brother and his auntie, and his parents were killed in Saddam Hussein's prisons. I had written a short story about him and wanted to write more. They pull this man out of the sea and he starts gabbling, and Alex thinks, you know, what's wrong with him? He's wearing a pair of shorts, it's February. Does anybody go in the sea in February around here? There are brave people who do, but it's really cold. I set it deliberately in February. And then Samir says, he speaks my language, Arabic. And this man is an asylum seeker who has been refused asylum from Iraq, and they decide to hide him to save him from being deported. Now, I wrote the book and set it in 2007 because that was the year that Iraq actually won the Mesopotamia Cup. It was a kind of post the Iraq War, a moment of sort of joy, really. The book came out in 2011. It always takes a while to get published and then get it out. And so it came out long before all these scenes that we've been seeing on our televisions in the last 2 years about migrants falling in the Mediterranean. But because of that, there's been a renewed interest in the book. And lots of people are sort of now, you know, saying, well, if you want to read about, you know, the refugee experience, have a look at Miriam's book. So one of the questions I was asked was, well, why did I write the book? Why write this book? And so really I need to go into the background of who I am, really. That when I worked in inner London, I worked a lot with asylum seekers. In the 80s, we had Vietnamese boat people and their children coming into the schools. And then we had the great Somalian exoduses coming in. So I've been kind of in and around asylum seekers probably all my life. My grandparents left Poland under the Russian control in the end of the 19th century because we are Jews. And the pogroms were on, and they had to leave. And they sort of eventually ended up in England. And so this whole idea of seeking asylum, and after I left teaching, I started to work with asylum seekers through the Medical Foundation for the Victims of Torture, and started to meet asylum seekers who wanted to write their stories down, and heard a lot of stories, many, many stories. Each story is individual, as you all know. And they become kind of sunk into the psyche. And then I worked with English Pen as well. So where an idea for a novel comes from is always a bit of a mystery. You know, why that day? I happened to be walking on the beach. My parents lived on Hailing Island for 25 years. They had died and I had gone back for a visit. Why that day this idea came into my head, who knows? But it's obviously a bringing together of a lot of things. And as I say, I had already written a short story about Samir. I'd been asked to write a story about the experience of being a child asylum seeker. And an entire story came into my head. And my child came from Baghdad in Iraq, because my husband's family come from there. I even know the names of streets and markets there. So I thought, well, I could bring that alive. My husband's family are Iraqi Jews. Their community is the oldest continuous Jewish community in the diaspora. It goes back 2,500 years to Babylonian days. But as many of you probably know, 1948 was the day of the year of exiles, those years of exiles in the Middle East. The Palestinians are on the move because of the creation of the State of Israel, but also all the Jews of the Middle East are being thrown out of their countries. And the entire Iraqi Jewish community, which was 50% of Baghdad, but only 120,000 people, got up and left in a short window they were given to leave, and they went to Israel. Which, of course, if Israel hadn't existed, they would have been in real trouble because they could hardly go to Europe. They just killed 6 million Jews. So there is a there's all these great exiles going on. And I knew, as a Jew, as a British Jew, very little about this, I might add. When I meet my husband and he starts talking to me about this community and what happened to them, and then I start reading about the other communities in the Middle East, I learned a great deal. So the whole process of where my asylum seekers are going to come from, and the whole experience of exile, is something that has been really a part of my life all my life. And there are two things that I learned about asylum seekers when I was working with them. And one was, they're all homesick. Now, people never really sort of think about that. You know, they think about, well, there's lovely Daily Mail headlines, all flocking here to seize our jobs. It's all about, we're being overwhelmed. They don't think about the individual on what that means, how homesick they are, how they miss their countries. If you've just watched this thing, War Child, on Channel 4 Sunday night, 12-year-old boy there from Afghanistan, and he's crying about how much he misses his family and his parents back in Afghanistan. And the other thing is that I would say 98 to 99% of these people will never go home again. They will never see their parents, their families. People have left children behind. And again, it's something that I think people don't really understand. And of course, I go into schools and I talk to young people who perhaps haven't thought about these things at all, and hopefully have some effect on their attitudes. So I did write my book because I did want to have an influence on any reader that read my book. I wanted them to stop and think about what might it be like to be an asylum seeker in this country. Samir, who is 14, who's walking with Alex on the beach, who's a 14-year-old girl who's never thought about asylum seekers or refugees or anything. The teacher has addressed it in school the day before, but they haven't. She's really got no idea at all. But Samir knows how hard it is to come into this country. He knows how hard it is to make your way and to settle. And he knows what's ahead for Mohammed, who they pulled out the sea. He's a 25-year-old student. He was an interpreter, interpreting for the Allied armies when they came in. Those armies couldn't have gone anywhere if they hadn't had willing Iraqis prepared to mediate for them. They wouldn't even know which way to go. They used to, you could see pictures of the Americans yelling in front of their tanks, which way is so-and-so, to the local population. And it's people like Mohammed and his older brother who interpreted for them. His older brother has been killed by militias. Once the Allies go, they're treated as traitors and spies. And Mohammed has been tortured, and his parents have paid for him to get out and leave the country. But the Home Office has refused him asylum. Because don't think that everyone who arrives here with torture marks on their bodies gets asylum, because they don't. And some of them get sent back and get injured again. So he's come in illegally. He's paid people smugglers, and they've thrown him out the boat. And so now Alex is faced with the greatest dilemma of her life. And I thought I might read the scene, just to give you a sense of their voices. So Mohammed's lying on the beach. At this point, I usually have one person lying here, and I have this as a play script, actually, and two of the teenagers read it. I've got to bring it alive somehow for them, you know. Otherwise, they just sit and look at me. Samir, we have to call an ambulance, says Alex. Samir doesn't move a muscle. He stands silently staring out to sea. Is he mad? He'll die out here, I say. It's freezing. I'm pulling on my coat and trainers as I speak. My fingers are too numb to tie the laces, and I can't even do the zip on my jacket. Samir has wrapped his denim jacket around the man's shaking shoulders, but he still doesn't seem to get it. Samir, I say firmly, but he still ignores me. I'm going home to phone 999. No! Samir turns and yells at me. No ambulance, no police. You mustn't even tell your mother. My mother? Why not? And I find myself staring into Samir's eyes, and there's that pleading look again, tugging away at me like the currents. I shake my head to clear it and say furiously, what are you going on about? He's going to get hypothermia. Yes, yes, I know. He's really cold and he hasn't eaten for 3 days. How do you know? He can't even speak clearly. Because he speaks my language, Arabic. Alex, he's an illegal immigrant, like Mr. Spicer talked about in class yesterday, and he's here without permission. Samir's voice drops to a whisper as he says these last words, and he looks nervously around in case someone's listening. Arabic? Samir's from some Arab country, and so is a stranger? It's very hard to think straight with my brain shuddering and my teeth chattering, they're all soaking wet, and my whole body shaking with cold. What do you mean? Why is he here? And why on earth did he jump into the sea on a day like this? He could have been killed. I start to run up the sand dune to see if anyone else is around. What would I say if one of the neighbours went past right now? Samir is calling up to me in a really desperate voice. We have to help him. He's run away from his country because they wanted to kill him. You know, like Mr. Spicer told us. He's an asylum seeker. Only in his case, the government, the Home Office, they refused him. So he's an illegal immigrant? Samir's voice fades away. Illegal? Oh, God. We have to help him, please, Samir. His name's Mohammed and he's hurt. He was tortured. What? Tortured, like my... But he doesn't finish. His eyes cloud over as he looks up at me. Help me to hide him, Alex, please, just for a couple of days. Hide him? Hide a stranger? I look back down to where the man is lying all scrunched up on the sand. His bruised eye looks so swollen. Someone must have punched him really hard. What did he do to deserve that? My feet feel as though they're sinking into the sand, and soon my whole body will be stuck fast, and I won't be able to run away even if I want to. Alex, we don't have much time. Someone will come. We'll be discovered very soon, or our man will die of cold. What should I do? We have to get in the hospital. Let's get him to the bus stop, okay, I say. No, we can't. You don't understand. He's here illegally, and the hospital will tell the police, and then he could get deported straight away. Trust me, Alex, we have to hide him now. But surely they've only got to look at him, I say. And what if they won't listen? Remember what Mr. Spicer said. He could be sent back and tortured or killed. We have to try to save him, Alex. It's a matter of life and death. And at that point, I tell the kids to turn to each other and decide what they would do. Because you know how it is, you know, you're taught, you know, never speak to a stranger, don't accept money from a stranger, don't take sweets from a stranger, and Alex is being asked to hide a stranger. So they quite enjoy that, and they discuss it between them, and I think when I wrote this book, I thought, well, now I'm going to go into school and talk about this stuff. What sort of reception am I going to get, you know? And I have been amazed, actually, that I've never yet had any kind of horrible stuff. Now, maybe, you know, the kids are not actually speaking out, but when they do speak out, they say things like, we would hide him, we'd tell our mum, we might go to the police. One boy did say he'd throw him back in again, but he was joking. But I go into all kinds of schools, and obviously what I think, well, what I'm trying to do in my book is to get young people to think about what it would be like to be in the shoes of this asylum seeker. But obviously I'm a fiction writer, and my job is to write a story that they want to read, fast moving, with characters that they really identify with, and a story and a journey they want to go on. You know, I'm not writing a political treatise, and I'm not writing a history, I'm writing a novel, it's fiction. And I also chose Hailing Island. I was really pleased that I thought about Hailing Island when I did this book, because I thought I want to set the book away from our great multicultural centres, so that it's not in the kind of, you know, the obvious place, you know, in Tottenham or somewhere. It's out there on a beach on Hailing Island, and one of the kids in the local schools who was interviewing me for his newspaper said to me, why on earth did you put together Iraq and a beach on Hailing Island? You know, and I thought that was really good, that he was really grappling with why I did that. And I did that because it could be anywhere and not in any specific place, and it could relate to anyone. So why did I write this as a novel, and why did I not write, you know, a good academic essay? Well, don't write academic essays, and I love writing fiction. But I have a great belief, and my experience of going to schools and talking to hundreds and hundreds of students is that they are very interested at quite a young age, and I'm talking 10, 11, 12 years old, in political and social issues. They say to me, what do you like to write, Miriam? You know, what's your genre? And I say, well, I don't write fantasy and sci-fi. You know, I write realistic novels, either historical or contemporary. And what inspires me is social and political issues. Now, that sounds really heavy. But, you know, and I say to him, but, you know, I want to write it in entertaining novels. But that's what interests me, and it always did right from childhood. That was what I read, and it's what I've always read. I did read a lot of sci-fi at one time. It came from a very sort of scientifically minded family. But I don't really read that now, although I have got a great idea for a Martian exhibition, but I can't work out the science, you know. But I've had young people very recently, again, coming up to me and saying, I really liked your book, because it's about real people. You know, in other words, like me, and usually I read fantasy, I say, and I think that they're fed a huge diet of fantasy. And I think that those of us who are writing these kinds of novels, and I think fantasy novels are fine, can actually speak to them about what's going on now. And the book has been published in America. It came out last year. And seventh graders have started to write to me. And 2 weeks ago, post-Trump era, one of them wrote to me about how much Hidden inspired him or her. The name is Kamal, which is a Muslim name, but it could be boy or girl. And they said, I hope in the future our world will have more tolerance and acceptance to other people around them. There's quite a lot going on in that country at the moment, and if my book can speak to them, that would be really, really good. And another point that that Emmanuel asked me to talk about was how has the book been received, which I've sort of somewhat started on, really. And very interestingly, I was at a festival in Middle England 2 weeks ago, and I was talking in an all-white school. This is, you know, well, I'm not saying it's that unusual, but normally I sort of find schools are a bit more mixed, but this is just a little sort of enclave. I won't say where it is. And at the beginning of Hidden, I have a scene because I sort of set everything up in this book and then deconstruct it. So I have a scene where Samir is bullied on the high street by the local well-known bullies, and they're yelling at him, you Paki, you Taliban, you terrorist. And these are words that are being banded around our streets and our playgrounds. And when I yell that out, just like on the football terraces, the kids all wince, which is very, very interesting, actually. And then I say to them, okay, so this word Paki, what is a person from Pakistan called? Can anyone tell me?
Pakistani.
And in every single school I go into, they could always answer that question, except this one school, which was very interesting. And then I say to them, right, so I am English and I am from England. And a Pakistani person is from Pakistan. When we had the great migrations from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh coming in the 1950s and 60s in this country, racism against these people started, and the word Paki was invented. It's not a real word, it's a racist word. So we go through the whole stages of it. And I was in a sixth form college in Tottenham, which was very mixed. And there were a couple of white people in the class. There was a white boy, about 17 years old, and he said to me, but Miriam, what's wrong with the word Paki? And he didn't know. And you can imagine the bristling around the room, so I then explained it. But I am assuming that this is a word that he hears at home and it is in common usage. And he really didn't know there was something wrong with it. So it was also interesting that in this particular school, there were some girls sitting in the front row. And, you know, at the beginning, I could see that they were quite tense about the subject of my book. And then towards the end, one of them said, you should care about these people. And the teacher came up to me and said, I think you've actually changed her mind. I don't think she'd ever really thought about what it might be like to be an asylum seeker. And so, you know, the reception of the book, I have been very, very pleased at how well it has been received. It's had this resurgence. It was long listed for the Carnegie Medal. The Sunday Times called it a book to counter bigotry. And then 2 years ago, I was approached by Stuart Mullins, who is a producer, theatre director. And he lectures in theatre at Hertfordshire University. And he said to me, I'd like to adapt your book for the stage. But this is not a commercial idea. It won't have like 10 weeks at the Hampstead or something. This is an educational project, and it will be coming down here to the South Coast, and you might see it. So at the moment, they have a wonderful playwright called Vicky Donoghue, who wrote a well-known play called Mudlarks about teens down by the river, and she has written her script. Next week, we've got the rehearsed reading at the Old Vic Workrooms, and then The plan is to tour this play around schools, community centres, small theatres, to lay down the challenge, you know, of what do we really think about the other in our society. And that could be anybody, actually, but in my case, I've chosen asylum seekers. I think that's probably enough to say.
Okay, thank you very much.